There we go. I probably don't have to explain it, but just like a reminder, Brown Mac is all about a conversation. It's not just a presentation. So whenever you feel like a question or a comment or you want to share your own experience, please. The way I've thought of running the Brown Mac is, first of all, I'll paint a picture of the theme that we're going for, and then give a little bit of background on BT Panorama, the onboarding redesign project that I, myself, and Sam worked on. And then from there on, go into a little bit more specific examples and lessons that we've learned from the project. So first of all, so if you look at a brown bag, looking at hindsight, it's quite powerful because the actual results of the things you've done. So it's very easy to go and analyze those actions. But one of the things that I thought of is those actions could have led to different results as well, and then you would have perceived those actions differently. And that kind of like leads into my next point, the evil of hindsight as well. So let's say you're 6 months into a project and things don't go that well. Your client will be using hindsight as well. And it's very easy for your client then to go and criticize the way you do things, even though in another circumstance, those actions would have led to a completely like successful project. And that's why I like that's kind of the theme of this whole brown bag is how do you actually defend the way you do things if you can't use the results as proof? So if things don't go well, you can't say like pair programming works excellently because look how fast we're programming. So what I want to talk about is, get the client buy-in while things are going well, because if things aren't going well, it's going to be a lot harder. So just do it as early as possible. Does that make sense? All right, so just a bit of a background on onboarding redesign. And you might
She
notice.
already doesn't look happy.
Well, she loves us. She's Fiona. She's a VA from BT Panorama. And you might have noticed like onboarding redesign background, and there's a background of the onboarding redesign thing. So, yeah. So during this year, we started to add, BT Financial Group. They brought us on board to help them build, rebuild. They already had an onboarding solution for their Panorama platform. So we came in, and our job was to rebuild their onboarding solution. Now, onboarding, they have the way they sell their products is they have advisors, and these advisors actually work with the investors. So the advisors are actually the customer that uses this platform. Now, the previous platform they had or the onboarding experience was terrible. Like, for example, if you want to onboard, let's say, a trust. And there are four members you have to select in the beginning. I want to onboard four members. But let's say you get down the line, you realize, okay, I actually made a mistake. There's absolutely no way for you to go back and fix it. So you have to scrap your entire application and then start up again. So there was definitely a big need for us. So even though our software-wise, we're only like a small little bit within a larger program, the program was about 300 people. Our team was about 20, so percentage-wise, it's tiny. It is critical because it's actually the first experience any of the customers will get. So in June, we ran an inception workshop for 2 weeks, and then after that, we kicked off. Initially, the client thought that it will be possible to deliver the project by September because in their minds, it was only like a few screens we had to build. Out of inception, it became clear that, that's not really the case. So we proposed a delivery date of March. And yeah, with a bit bit of tweaking and them taking on some risks and adding more people, that timeline was brought back to December, or kind of so we thought. And I'll get into more specifics. But yeah, that was kind of the original plan. Right now, the delivery date looks more like, I think, July. That's kind of on July next year.
So what was the key difference between their initial thinking and what came out of Inception?
So, okay, their very initial thinking was, we'll just build screens and not integrate at all. And when I say not integrate at all, I mean not even talk to the web server, just JavaScript front end screens, like very easy, you know, just a few forms. And we made them realize, you know, that's not a good idea, because if you don't actually talk to something, you know, it's, you know, like later on integration is going to be so difficult. So they agreed to that.
It's worth giving the context, well, so like historically, BT have tried to run large programs with lots of teams that all depend on each other and actually run in parallel. And they have a long period of systems integration testing, which is something that we hopefully believe should be a formality. But they actually use that to do like SRO work and to actually make it work. And so they wanted us to play a role which was, you know, one of those teams in that existing model.
And the long testing cycle, we're talking 6 months. That's, so their March release, they started testing that in September. Right.
Is there a little bit of program context as well? So they've gone out, the original onboarding design, they've gone out to their party vendor to deliver this part of the experience.
Yeah.
And it was only through late feedback on the user experience that they realized, well, we've got a lot of other program work in flight that depends on that. And now we realize that we probably need to rewrite if we're going to have anything like an acceptable user experience.
Yeah, so for the
program, so yeah, very close to the end where it all had to line up, their entry points into it, they're taking a big risk on like starting again because they realize what they had.
And they actually started that 9 months after they started the other work. So as you can imagine, quite a lot of pressure. Right, so that's a bit of background. Okay, just jumping straight into that might not give the whole context. Coming back, reversing a little bit to the timeline now, looking more like July next year. In the beginning, this project was quite green because we didn't hit like the obstacles of integration yet, because like the backend teams weren't ready for us yet. And there, you know, I'm not saying that's the only cause for the blowout, but over about a 3 week period, the project went from like glowing green, like everyone was just speaking of how well we were doing, to quite red. And we discovered that both our scope was actually a lot more than what we initially thought, and also because our progress, especially during integration, just slowed down dramatically, that the timeline just shot out from like December, Jan to July next year. Now, as you can imagine, you know, like the perception of performance is or would be quite negative. And we had to deal with a lot of that with this relationship. So I'm just going to jump in now. So how can we proactively manage the perception of our team? First of all, just understand the expectations of your client and what they expect you to deliver. Now, this is something, and I wasn't in the Consulting 101, but I heard that Consulting 101 addresses this. So one of the examples I read up on, if you're a 5-star hotel and someone comes here but you only give them like a 4-star rating, the perception of your delivery would be probably worse than a 1-star delivering a 2-star performance. Same with promises. If you set the expectation in the beginning that you can actually do an aggressive timeline, or you agree to, okay, well, you know, this is an aggressive timeline, but you know what? We know it's risky, but we'll go with it. Like very soon, people will forget that originally it was an aggressive timeline, But what they'll see is, okay, well, you're running behind schedule, and that's what they'll base their perception of your performance on. So it's not necessarily your development team's performance, it's just that initial expectation. I think this is also where the client principles can play quite an important role in the beginning. So, for example, let's say there's a delivery versus transformation. And if you kind of promise that this team will be doing a lot of transformation as well, you're setting up that expectation. So if you don't actually get to do that, you know, the customer will be disappointed. The next learning, paint an early picture of or lesson. I learned today that the word learning actually doesn't exist. It's lessons. So paint an early picture of your practices. And this is just, again, repeating that if you paint it early while things are going well, it's easy to have that conversation. If you're trying to have that conversation when things aren't going well, you don't actually have a foot to stand on. And also, if you don't get that buy-in from the customer, in hindsight, they'll then later on look at things like development pairing. It's like, well, you know what? You guys have been coding now for 6 months. We're not going that fast. So, you know, obviously this pairing thing you're doing is not really working. It might have been in the back of their minds from the beginning, like, okay, it's actually a lot of money I'm spending on this, but they never actually say something because everything's going well until things change. So that's why in the beginning, you know, have a very open discussion with them and explain the advantages of doing development pairing, for example, before you actually put two developers in front of one screen and hope everything's going to work out. And again, just jump in with any comments if you want to. Then another one, and I think this is also important, analyze just-in-time versus upfront analysis. Now, you know, it's very easy to go and explain to a customer that, you know, the agile way is the good way of doing things, but you need to explain the pros and cons as well. And you need to know that they understand the trade-off, because obviously you'll find out a little bit more later on in the project. It does open you up a little bit for risk, but at least you don't waste all the upfront time. So knowingly, if they go into that saying, okay, well, we're not going to waste that upfront time, you know, we might discover things later on, that's okay. So they're happy with it later on if it happens, you know, it's just a repeat. It's not then retrospectively you have to go and explain or try and explain that it's actually not a bad idea.
The only thing about
one of the things I wanted to add to what Willem said there is, I think one of the learnings that we can take away as well is during the first like 3-4 iterations, we took on a lot of the really easy work. And from that, we weren't able to get a lot of learnings up front about how difficult some of the work that we knew was going to be hard was, which meant that our estimations on that work remained naive when they probably shouldn't have been. And so, like, there's something about sort of front-loading difficult work here as well and trying to figure out exactly how you can kind of get some experience of what it's like tackling those harder problems so that your project map looks a little bit more accurate, along with kind of just-in-time updating it and making sure that it's curated and you're kind of like looking at it all the time.
Wow, Sam, you beat me to it, because that's what I was going to ask, is that I think there's an important part to that. One is, yep, front-load the stuff that you know will be risky, because if you can't do the risky stuff, a lot of that early investment could be wasted. So suddenly you find you can't do the risky stuff at all, it's just as much waste as all the upfront analysis. The other part of it is, it's important on us as teams that when we're doing that just-in-time analysis, which I think is the right thing to do, we should also be looking and identifying where's the risk, so that we can at least spike some things early, and so that, again, it's about confirming, is our plan realistic?
are we really going to be able to deliver it? There will still be things that jump up and bite you. There always are, even if you do 7 months, 8 months, 9 months of analysis up front. But it is important for us as teams to look at what do we feel a bit icky about here. Let's do a bit more of a deep dive into specific areas if we think there's something, a gotcha hiding in that forest.
And I think one of the things we did do well, so there was quite a dependency on another team to get the back-end system ready for us, and they only gave us like a delivery date of end of September when they'll be ready for us to actually like talk with their system at all. So we actually pushed quite hard to get from the beginning, well, it's actually three teams, like the backpacking system, Avaloq, and then there's like this middle integration bus team, and then us. So we actually got them together like twice a week where we actually did all the technical analysis and stuff, because before that it was just document passing between project managers, and it was actually quite scary to see how misaligned they were when we first got them into a room, where they immediately like, oh, but wait a minute, I thought you guys are going to do that and that, like, oh, no. So, you know, it is trying to bring that risk forward, but unfortunately, sometimes there are still like dependencies where you can't actually try something out until a certain date.
And that's fine. But we do need to be strong with ourselves, identify those risks, where we can mitigate and where we can't. Here's the list of the things we can't. And it's part of the message. I love the message, which is controlling that perception. As soon as we know we can't mitigate that risk, start flashing it out there.
Even like some visualization around that upcoming like lack of visibility or something, like whether that's a forecast of like the upcoming iterations where that comes in and that's a rocky forecast, or it's a level blurring or something like that, that's something that I think we could have made more clear. And then we also could have made it more clear kind of once we did hit that rocky waters, exactly how much work that was causing. I think we... I think Nick and kind of did a poor job communicating exactly how much effort was being spent on it, and that kind of effort never really got communicated up. It was kind of like, well, I'm skipping ahead in the story, but we kind of had one showcase that didn't go so well, and then like 2 days later, you know, like Willem said, things went from bright green to bright red, like the shit hit the fan, and that was a lot of our problem in how we communicated those things.
I had a question to something you. Which was having the like initial buy-in, having the client be really confident about what your practices are. I wanted to ask how you can tell when that's not happening, because it kind of seemed like things, I mean, just from my perspective, it kind of seemed like things were going quite well and our relationship was quite good at the beginning. So how would we have been able to tell at the beginning that wasn't there?
So I think the big thing is not to assume. Even if you assume someone would be fine with you running in a certain way, still have the conversation. You know, it just aligns you. And you know, you can be upfront and just say, you know, you can ask them if they're okay with that practice. You know, if there are any concerns, you know, you can deal with it then. If you know, 6 months from then, you won't be able to deal with it.
I think if there's any practices which affect the timeline ultimately, and you're not communicating the cost of that or the impact of working in that way, you're essentially taking on the responsibility of making that decision. And you know, a little bit of cynicism goes a long way. You know, if we kind of internalize some of our decision making, that is something that can be used against you at a later point.
And I don't know if you saw Darren's post on the taxi driver. Same thing. You know, you're coming in as the driver and you have the knowledge. If you just assume that the client will know that if you do certain things in a certain way that it will affect the timeline, you know, that's actually your mistake. You need to have that conversation, make sure that they know. Right.
Yeah, I think in addition to conversations earlier, but like one of the big disconnects is that what BT thought things were ready when they were ready meant was different than what we thought things were ready when they're ready. So like sort of we had two different definitions and we never kind of came to a shared understanding of what those two were. So both of us were kind of like communicating with one another. We were communicating, but we were talking about different things, or we were talking about kind of like we had different presumptions. We didn't have exactly the same premises of what we were working on. So even though we were kind of doing a good job at communicating, we did a poor job at understanding each other before we started communicating.
Yeah, so the right down to that simple level of what does done mean?
As we actually, during inception, we read through their BT's definition of done, and we actually accepted that as our definition of done. But reading through a document doesn't reflect reality, of course.
Yeah. There can be only one.
Yeah.
It's all hindsight. It's hindsight now. There are some things we can do, but you guys know it. You guys lived it.
Yeah. And I need to kind of apologize. I'm painting quite a gloomy picture with this presentation. You know, it wasn't just all bad, but, you know, lessons kind of mostly come from things you think you could have done better.
Yeah.
So that's kind of all right. And then also one of the things also up front before you run an inception, just clearly explain what the outcome of the inception will be. I remember actually someone asking us, and that's after we thought that we explained what an inception is about. At the end of the inception, like, how many screens have we built already? You guys have been really busy for 2 weeks. And it's like, okay, you know, obviously there's a bit of a misalignment in expectations. And then progress tracking, the overhead versus visibility. Now, some teams, you know, don't even do Fibonacci estimations. You know, like, it could be fine in some cases. So let's say, you know, you have all your work, you kind of think it will take 3 months and you happen to deliver it in 3 months, then that's perfectly fine. You know, you didn't waste a lot of effort. Yes.
It's not fine. It's really generally not so fine in most instances. Because in most instances, you're talking to a client who wants to know roughly what they need to spend for what return, so they can make a call, is the return worth it? IWF is weird in that I have never seen them produce a business case. But for most of our clients, we need to be confident to within reason, because things always bite you in the butt. There are always unknowns or the scope changes halfway through. But for most of our clients, we need to be able to have an informed conversation about projected cost, projected effort. And when they come up with something new, we need to be able to say, what do you not want us to do that's about an equivalent size? Mm. So we need to know for our own benefit how we do that negotiation.
And I'm actually getting to that point.
Sorry.
It's perfectly fine. And I agree with you. And it's something that you can do early on to protect that perception later on. So in some cases, even though some projects would have run smoothly without having Fibonacci numbers, if the result was fine, then the client would have been happy. But if the result was not that fine, then it would have been much harder to recover. Right, this one I stole from Angela. So have your hard conversations early and often. Now, especially if you look at scope, even if you're going to miss the target deadline by 1 day, still have a scope triage session and move something out that will be 1 day's worth of work. Because one of the things, you'll kind of have control along the project, sure. But the other kind of more important thing is the client will become comfortable with that conversation while it's easy. And like later on, if something big happens, it might not be your project's fault, but something big happens, you know, they're good with that conversation and they're comfortable having that conversation with you. All right, communication. So there's kind of also a few lessons that I've taken away from it. So ask yourself who pays you, and don't let any messages get filtered between you and that person. So for example, with PT, the program manager obviously was paying us. Well, not obviously, but you know, he was the guy signing off. But he actually asked for, there's project managers on BT's side, and he wanted the project manager to kind of collate a, like from a few different streams, the, you know, what's happening, and then report to him. Now the thing is, like, that's a filter.
Yeah.
And especially if some of the things you report kind of conflict with that person's own interest, because maybe one of her teams is doing something that is affecting your performance, you don't know how that conversation or how that message is actually going to be filtered. So just one big thing, and that's what I'm definitely going to do going forward as well, is make it clear from the heads up, like, even if that person wants to send your messages to a spam folder, that's fine, but you're still going to report to that person. Then the next one is ask your stakeholders for help, and they want to help. So even if it's something small, and like we've had the program director ask us, you know, is there anything I can do for you? A big kind of no-no is no, everything's fine. Like that kind of puts that you wanna make it comfortable for that person and a habit for that person to help you and also feel valuable because that person actually wants to help you. Like if you kind of just keep that blanket, no, everything's fine, and you think you'll be able to deal with the small issues, it kind of, it, the visibility for that person into what you have to deal with, that's cut off. And then eventually when you come up with this big issue, you know, it will be a lot harder for that person to actually help you.
I think you can have much more frank conversations as well. You know, there are people, intermediaries, jobs at risk, or whatever, if you say a message that potentially makes them look bad. They're the parts of those things.
But I think it's a great point. When they come and ask, can we help? You know, sometimes it's okay to say, look, we've got these five or six things going on. We think we have a mitigation plan in place. So right now we're good, because they still know that they know you've got it. But it just means that if two of those things go horribly belly up and you can't deal with it, they're ready for that. So, because you're not always going to have stuff you want them to do. But yeah. I think you're right. Absolutely share with them what you're facing, but let them know you've got it. Because it still maintains a conversation and a bond.
There's also a psychological thing, though, where, like, slightly paradoxically, if you want someone to do you a big favour, the best way to get them to do that is to have previously asked them for a small favour.
Yeah.
Right, it's like scratch my back and then scratch my back again, because you kind of train them in that way that they help you, and that itself is its own reward. It's like a weird trust thing going on.
Yes.
So if you kind of have in the background the, oh, you know what, the team is running out of Sharpies. I'm even not that low level of stuff, but that kind of little things that just like, that's a no brainer for you. It's a 5-minute conversation with someone. It's done. You feel good. Then when it comes up to the big stuff, like holy crap, the scope's exploded. They're kind of in that, like, trained the habit of helping you already.
And I think one of the things as well, you know, if something goes wrong and that's a surprise to someone, they've got to have a message for their bosses immediately on what's just happening. If it's a shock or they don't have any context, then that's going to put them out and into them, because they don't align, they don't have any visibility into what's led up to that.
I think one of the things I'm also going to try in the future is, let's say, at that moment, you really don't have anything to ask of. You know, you have Sharpies and everything. One of the things you can maybe ask is, you know, come and join us at the wall and come and speak to the team.
Come to our showcase. That would be great. We'd love you to come to our showcase, because it would give the team a real boost.
Yeah.
That's a small thing for them, but it's, yeah, absolutely.
Sorry. Yeah, I think just to add one other thing here is that being proactive about that pursuit is the key here, because like we did invite Ford, who's the program, the business program manager, and like all of the program managers, they did come to a couple of showcases, and you know we did have an open invite that was kind of like having them come up and take a look at the wall or come to our stand-ups. But like if you're not constantly kind of refreshing that relationship and constantly talking with them, it just became a thing that they didn't do anymore, and we've lost that kind of line of communication with them. So because of that, when things went wrong, it got filtered through the wrong person and distributed in the wrong way, rather than kind of like being able to kind of talk about that discreetly to the people who it actually impacted, and then allowing them the ability to disseminate that message and to make decisions that would help that message and the problems kind of come to a better conclusion.
And I think Will, you guys are making a really good point, and Will is the first point on that slide about who pays you and making sure you talk to them directly. I think we're in this glorious position of we're there to do a job of delivering in this case, and so we do need to fit in with the delivery reporting structure. But because we're a consulting company, we do have a responsibility to the person who pays us. So actually, we can set up a different conversation with that person, which is a commercial one, which is about an engagement conversation. You know, are we ThoughtWorks providing you the kind of value that we would want to and that you would want us to? And here are the things that are prohibiting us from doing that. So it's not breaking the program reporting structure, but it is having a strong commercial relationship, which actually helps you build a good delivery relationship too. So even if you feel uncomfortable going, like sometimes it feels like you're going above the person you're reporting to, from a like program manager to the CIO. If you separate the conversation, you're going above that person, you're having a different conversation.
And also that's a good place to use a CP, right? Because they should be doing it. That's actually legit and kosher for them to do that. That's not going above anyone. So you can kind of get them to get you in front of those right people, and then that's
I think
yeah.
So that's sorry, Sam. Did you want to add something?
Well, I think it's sort of related to this, which is the other thing is like not all of it. I think a lot of times we focus on like getting executive approval because at many clients it's difficult to kind of get that cachet, and we often have more approval with boots on the ground. But here I think we had like quite a lot of executive approval, but we did a poor job at kind of getting people on the ground and in the middle layer to kind of come over to our side. And so when Narai, who is the person who is kind of filtering the information, when she kind of gave the information in a filtered way, there was nobody who was kind of allied with us to speak out and say, wait a minute, that's not how it is, this is how it really is, and we're there experiencing that with them. So there's something about integrating with the client team as well, and not walling yourself off and something in there as well.
I think just because your structure, we did have that structure in place where we had a different conversation, but unfortunately that like the more regular updates, like if you're blind to what is actually reported versus what you're reporting, that opens you up to like if it's just upfront open communication, like you can read it if you want, you can't, at least you know what's put out there. There's, you kind of open your, like, I understand what you mean, you have to respect the reporting structure within a company. But I think if you can actively in the beginning push to be more visible and say, like, you know, we strongly believe that visibility is a good thing, so we're going to put it out there for, you know, these CIO to be able to read it as.
You're right, and that's primary option. That's always going to be first go-to, but we all learn, and we've all learned it the hard way. You also need to be having the fortnightly, three-weekly commercial catch-up, which is about the account.
Yeah.
And I certainly know we've had to disengage with some of our clients in the past, but we've actually used the account meeting to discuss delivery issues, which get us to a healthy disengagement. So, you know, you didn't discuss delivery issues in that account discussion, right? Which means they get the unfiltered message. But I'm just saying, when this happens, we have the power of the secondary conversation that we can use in that meeting.
Yeah. All right. So I think we already talked about my third point. Do stakeholders visit your wool? They should. Showcases alone are not good enough. Now, I know like probably most people do it at showcases, invite people to come over to your wall. That open invitation, like people are busy, they wouldn't necessarily come. Get it in their calendar, follow up with it, make sure they actually come and visit you. And if it becomes more of a habit, because the few times that our key senior stakeholders actually came to our wall, they were actually amazed with like what they learned, because they spoke directly with the team, and they didn't get like an unfiltered version that went. Especially if you look at the program director, by the time news got to her, you know, like eventually it's just one little bullet point in a deck that someone has to present that heard it from someone. You know, just to get that direct conversation is just priceless. And with that visit to the wall, you kind of, in a friendly manner, go past the reporting structure of the company, because you can't help what they're going to ask you, and that's okay. Right, and then do all your team members get the opportunity to speak to senior stakeholders? They should. Again, I don't think there's anything more valuable than hearing directly from a developer how painful a slow build pipeline is. So give that opportunity. And like, you know, that walk the wall, and just introducing that person to the team, you know, that could be something where, you know, you kind of just can lead up to a conversation. And all of that is kind of to avoid the why didn't I know this sooner question later. All right, dealing with non-delivery perceptions. So these are actually some things I heard at BT. The kids, arrogant, loud, not working full days.
3 out of 4 is not bad.
Okay, I don't think you can control all non-delivery perceptions, but I think, you know, if we just go through these, like for example, the kids. Now, I know with ThoughtWorks, a lot of the times the client doesn't necessarily have that much control of the people we place, but we can maybe be a bit more upfront with the balance in skills that we're bringing in, or like. Someone young doesn't mean they're going to do a poor level of development, not at all, but I have that conversation early on as well and say, you know, we have some junior people that we're going to pair up with more senior people. They're excellent at what they do, because, again, if they have any concerns, they can raise it then, not 6 months later when you're not delivering on time. Then how do you explain it? And then arrogant, loud. Now, one of the things I thought of with arrogant, loud is it's an outside perspective. So if people just see you there and you're loud and screaming and stuff, it's much easier to have that perception.
Were you screaming?
Laughter that got a little bit happy sometimes.
Well,
not really screaming.
I feel like for me, having fun is a fundamental being part of a ThoughtWorks team, and it's a really important part of being a ThoughtWorks team. But we also need to remember we're in someone else's house. And they work in their house in a certain way, right? So having fun is one thing, like being the only team on the floor who ever utters anything other than a whisper. We just need to be aware of that kind of stuff.
There's sometimes the balance of the bringing the culture in to go ahead and change the way they think as well. But I can imagine if you're in a rough spot, or if there's a perception of delivering offensively happening, and then hearing happy voices, that can get people upset sometimes.
Mm.
But I think, do you guys realize how serious this is, that we're not on track and things like that?
I think that was some of it. I think we were exceptionally loud, but I think we were a lot happier than they were expecting us to be.
And it doesn't that being happy means that we're not serious about the work.
Yeah, exactly. And I think
was still that kind of comment.
Sorry, I interrupted, because I think Will was talking about it being an outside perception.
Yeah, so obviously we need to be mindful that we're in someone's house. But I think, like Courtney also said, it wasn't like we were overly loud. And when I say screaming, it's not like someone who's in the other side of the building is like, hey, Sam. But I think,
of course, I'm the one screaming, not the other person.
Well,
was that because it was Sam screaming, hey, Courtney?
Sam, I did that on purpose. So I think, okay, it's just an idea, but if we can be more out there with things like brown bags, where we discuss the way we do things, and also let's say we're working on a platform and we have ideas, constantly to put up, like, we need to market ourselves, because otherwise other people will market us.
Yeah.
And you don't know what that marketing will look like.
Yeah.
So things like brown bags is your direct communication with the broader teams, and also, you know, like other stakeholders. So that's kind of my idea with getting rid of the whole arrogant lab. You're there, you're sharing your perspective and ideas, and you're helping them as well.
I think there might also be something around getting sort of the key stakeholders / whoever's paying us to visit another project that we're running if they're a new client, so they know what they're getting into. So we can say, hey, look, this is what our teams look like. You can see there's stuff all over the walls. There are build lights and sounds going off. People are talking when they're developing. Like, it's quite a noisy, in many senses of the word, environment. So that's the way it looks. Are you okay with that in your floor? Should we say, put us in a meeting room where we're out of the way, we're not going to distract your other people? Do we need to have some kind of, you know, quiet office hours are? Like, really call that out so that it's not a nasty surprise when they suddenly get not people who just kind of, like, the clack of the keyboard is all you hear.
But you've also got to remember, especially with this team in the context, which is part of a larger program, so being in a room, probably not an option. Bringing other people into coffees or whatever, if it's hash brown Fridays, whatever you guys are doing, sometimes getting someone from adjoining teams to come with you, takes away that stick to beat you with, because suddenly they're all part of the making noisy thing, right? So, but I think it's a really good point.
Yeah, even inviting people.
I have to say, my perspective on this is that one of the things we did really, really poorly at first, and that we've improved substantially on, is even within the BT FTEs that were on our team, we did a poor job at including them in things. So this isn't even about socializing or marketing ourselves, I don't think. It was about trying to understand how we bring them along in our way of working that they may or may not be used to. So there was, I think a lot of this came from things like, we didn't go and ask the BT BAs to help us kick off a story. We didn't go with them and look at their acceptance criteria and say, oh yeah, look, maybe we don't have to do this, or does this make sense or anything? And as soon as we started doing that, both the XDs and the, both the XD and the BAs that were on the team really, really changed their opinions of us. And that was something that we failed at, like, just utterly miserably at first. It was really a poor work on our part, and we've substantially improved that relationship.
Cool.
So, just out of curiosity, so I'm sure you folks would have had retros and things like that at intermediate points in the project, right? So, did some of these things come up during those conversations as well, or is it mostly that now that you have the time to just sort of sit down and think about, hey, what could have been done differently, and it is coming up more now than earlier?
I think it's more coming up retrospectively now. I think with the retros, The BT guys were pretty quiet in the retros, and it was mostly development focused. And there are some techniques we could have used to make sure that we get more of their opinions. But I think, like, a lot of these are coming like retrospectively.
Because I at the time we just sit and think about.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Everyone's curious.
Yeah, I mean, like again, I think in a lot of ways, at least I recall these some of these issues coming up at retros, but really kind of solidified it when you look at when devs go and they need to pick up a story and they go to Rasha, or when we have a question about something, they were always going to Rasha, and it's so easy to kind of stay with the people that you know and not get out of that bubble at all. But we really just completely alienated the BT employees, and as soon as we started including them, they almost immediately became allies with us because they knew the trouble that we were going through. We've had two new PMs come on to start doing this project plan since Willem has left, and the two PMs that came on both came on with the perspective that, like, this ThoughtWorks team, they're fucking it up. They're, you know, things aren't going well. They don't know how to manage projects. I'm going to march in there and get this right. And because we've worked so closely with them and because we've kind of, like, made sure that every issue they're aware of, they're actually being useful, it's come to the point now where they're totally understand the pain points that we're feeling because they're feeling them too. So I think sharing and making sure you merge. If there's one thing that I would have come out of the inception changing is like an insistence that there were like full-time BT devs on the team, because that also becomes an ally once they're on there and they know how to navigate the political waters of the organization. There's so much around that. So
yeah.
Can we talk about the working full days? Because
yeah.
I had this problem at IOOF with a team that had no delivery issues whatsoever that was delivering months earlier than the church.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I actually wanted to say I thought that the not working full days is a symptom of running late. Well, not a symptom, but
you get
when people think that, we're running late because you're not working hard enough, then they're going to claim that you're not working full days, even though you are. But it is interesting to find out from you that they think that even though we're delivering ahead of time.
So when you say working, not working full days, you mean that we're just working 8 hours and not more than that? Or
we're thought workers, right? So stand-ups at half night, so you woke up at 20 past nine.
Okay.
Or, I don't know, because you work till 7 o'clock at night and no one on client site does, they only see you arrive at 9:30, and then you have to stand up, and then the whole team goes for a coffee, and there's this meeting, and that. And so what they don't see is the check-in at home, and so it's how you manage that perception. You're right, the stick gets heavier if delivery is not on track, but it's still a stick when delivery is on track, because, you know, you guys could be doing so much more for us. Okay, it's going well, but would you be finished by now?
Yeah, because it's such a visible thing, right? Are there bodies sitting at the desks bashing keyboards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, if a certain perception is if a developer's not sat at a keyboard bashing the keys, they're not being productive. Whereas, you know, if they're sat in a coffee shop talking about, like, the design and things with some other developers, that's really super productive.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're not allowed to be noisy in the office. But it's unseen, right? And that I found it really hard, like as a PM, because you've got developers and team members who are coming and saying, look, we're doing our time. Look at my timesheets. Here's my thing. Why are we being clock-watched so hard? Mm. We're working really hard. We're delivering really well. Why are you beating us up about this? And it's like, I have no idea. Like, I think there's a...
Yeah, I think want to emphasize how much I agree with Tom. Like, you're still... And like at BT specifically, like the program manager has the perception that if the developers are running at full throttle, even though they're in like first gear or second gear, when developers are running at like a healthy pace in third or fourth gear, the people who are running at full throttle are the ones who are kind of like, they're the ones getting work done. It's they must be doing everything. They're kind of sitting down coding all day. I completely agree with you. That's a perception that's really difficult to change.
Well, I think maybe it just shows that within the company itself, the culture has mistrust. So if they don't trust their guys to do work, if they don't see them working, you know, maybe there's just like a sign of that happening in the company itself.
It's a non-outcomes-based thing, but it doesn't, because it's a perception, again, it doesn't really matter. Like we say, it doesn't matter if you're delivering or not, you still get beaten up over
it's
that.
It's the perception. But I don't think it's okay for us to say it just means there's... I'm sure it's not what you're saying, to say, oh, it just means they've got a trust issue, because at the end of the day, regardless of how successfully we've delivered that perception leaves a bad smell.
Yeah.
And so I think we as a group have a responsibility to be aware that we're at risk of this, because it's a pattern that I see over and over and over again. And we have to think about, what does this look like to the clients' teams around us? What are they thinking when we suddenly disappear? Because we do.
Yeah.
And some of that is back to that point that Sam was making about when you go and ask the BTBA's question. Taking some of the client devs into that discussion with you means that, one, they're also not at their desk. It means that, two, they see the kind of things that you're talking about. They understand why this stuff's important. And going back to something Tom said earlier, and you were talking about earlier as well, these are the kind of things we want to be using our CPs to be setting up with the client before we ever put it in the ground, right? Our teams will get up and we'll go and have these discussions. And they have them for these reasons, and here's the value.
And I think Black Friday lunches, for example, as well.
Yeah.
Don't surprise your client by disappearing for 2 hours on a Friday for lunch. Just explain beforehand. As ThoughtWorks, we get together every Friday because that's our only opportunity to get together as a company over lunch period, and just expect the guys to, you know, be out for a bit of a longer duration.
I think I've seen this take over, like, things you for their perception that we're not doing ours. It's like we've missed our opportunity to have brought them into, you know, the regular rhythm. It seems that they can see actually the work that we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we just not control our perception.
Mm-hmm.
But look, if they didn't you, it's a great opportunity. If they didn't you in week 3, it's a great opportunity to bring them in and totally turn them around.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's almost better in some circumstances. Scratch this from the recording. It's almost better in some circumstances to be dinned in week 2 and recover really strongly than to never be dinned.
Absolutely. But I think some of the themes in this is like we've ridden a wave of optimism, and, you know, all the people on the client side's reservations, they just internalized them. They thought them anyway. But only said them once we were exposed. And it's like, and this.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe it's just like, you know, the more you bring people on with the ride and therefore make them complicit, they don't have an answer.
Yeah.
That's true. Equally shared guilt.
Okay. No worries. So inception scope and estimation smells. Now, the reason I'm bringing up these smells is, you know, you can look out for them and deal with them early on. And again, it's easy to deal with them earlier than later. So these are just kind of some of the things that we picked up during this project. So if you're only a small part within a larger application, it's a big warning sign. You don't really know what you're going to deal with. You don't know the quality of the code you're going to deal with. You're going to be open to a lot of dependencies from other teams as well. So it is worth adding more contingency. And it's hard to have the conversation with the client, because if you're telling them, I don't know how your platform looks like, therefore I need to add more contingency. They're like, whoa, but, you know, our platform is actually really good. You know, it's a difficult conversation to have, but what we saw, and in the end it became reality, is in the end it turned out to be very slow to work in this platform, and our hands were tied in many ways, because we're just this one little small bit. So it's just a smell to look out for. Here's a quote as well. But you're only building screens. You really think it will take that long? Let me confirm that with my guys. Now, I think the more important thing there, let me confirm that with my guys. We actually had to deal with that repeatedly, where our estimations were questioned. And Nick also made a good point. You do question yourself after a while. It's like, okay, well, maybe my estimation is a little bit too big.
Yeah.
But just be warned. Just rather say, well, based on what we know now, this is it. if we end up delivering quicker, fantastic.
But I think, like, I think you're right. Based on what we know now, this is as accurate as we can be. However, because we plan in whatever, is it 1 weekly or 2 weekly iterations, right? We have a checkpoint every 2 weeks that lets us know, are we going faster or slower? So we can have this conversation every 2 weeks and revisit. So it's not we plan now and that's it. So we're giving them that constant feedback loop.
Yeah.
Rather than in 6 months' time, we'll know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think you're right. This is what we know now and what we can know now.
I think one of the, it comes back to the point before about taking on the easy stuff first. You know, if you've got a bunch of your scope which is dependent on other teams and then you've got some stuff which is in your control, you can give a false perception of the consistency, the velocity. If you're kind of saying, oh, well, that's the hard stuff and then other teams will leave that and we'll just do the stuff that we control, we have control of. Because once that work runs out, you're going to hit a brick wall. Once you start touching the scope that touches the rest of the organisation, it's going to reveal all those integration problems. And it's not always apparent, I guess, depending on how you structure the work, when you're going to hit the problems that are going to cause you. I think that's what I'm
And one thing I want to add as well. So changing timelines on the books doesn't actually mean the time is changed. So for example, and that's the next one, with the contingency, we originally went to BT and they wanted the fixed price, but they were happy to move over to time and material because that would give them the flexibility to help us if we run behind schedule to add people if required. But if you actually don't make a change to the team then and there, that will affect the timeline, don't change the timeline until that's done. That's just my learning, because people quickly forget that timeline is based on them having to help later on if you don't meet it. You know, that conversation is forgotten.
I think you're right, but I think it's about how you share the assumptions and the dependencies around any plan, because you probably have 5 versions of a plan, each with a different set of assumptions about the numbers of pairs or the amount of crap that you find when you lift the hood and go, oh, it's ugly. I think it really is how you share those things, because often when we're quite honest about contingency and fixed price, it's amazing how many clients go, oh, well, no, I'll take the time and materials option then. You get the same stuff for about the same cost.
There's something about the project timeline that particularly, like, they needed this ready by a certain point. So the inception conversation, I mean, contingency doesn't go away based on the billing model, does it? I mean, if you're trying to estimate a 6-month body of work up front, we have to be able to project the number of plans to say, what if everything bad happened? Do we blow the date? And therefore, should we start this project or not? I think we lost the conversation around contingency through the change in bill.
Yeah, in fixed price, we definitely have contingency, right? Because we're carrying all the risk. Time and materials, we think the client carries more risk, but actually, not so often.
And the perception, again, at the end, won't be like, oh, I'm happy, you know, I said I'm carrying the risk. It's like, well, you guys didn't deliver on the day.
Funnily enough, yeah, that's how the conversation actually goes. Mm. What are you guys going to do to fix this?
Yeah.
What's it like? T&M implies something about delivery to some degree, right? But de facto, if we're the largest number of bodies on the ground, it will be assumed that we are.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. And then, that bit, you don't have to worry about it. We'll build that part. So that's the smell. We as the client, they'll build a certain part within this project. Now, just be wary of the smell with that. That first of all, maybe they don't even have people yet available. So in our case, they actually had to hire people to build that part. Now, what this opens you up for is, okay, you're either going to create a separate dependent piece of work, and dependencies generally aren't good. You want to be that end-to-end delivery. So that's fine from a project, like your own estimation points that, okay, well, we have control on this, but now we have this dependency on that team versus, okay, well, we're actually going to include those guys into our team because it makes sense, because it's end-to-end. But if you don't estimate that piece of work and kind of just assume that, well, not assume, but this team within your larger team, they're going to manage their own time. It kind of opens up your entire project for scope creep because new work can be fit. And that's what happened with us as well. Work is fit into these guys' work schedule, but that's not estimated work. And the outside perception is it's still you as a delivery team. So it's just be wary of a situation like this.
It's either that or you build a release plan that has a clear assumption this thing and integrating with it is out of scope. The integration and the responsibility of the new team, because then you can have that conversation, right? Because you've said, we're not building that, we're not even thinking about that, you have elected to take on that responsibility.
Yeah.
And you have this great conversation where people either go, yeah, or they go, maybe we should get you guys to do it, in which case you have the conversation about, well, it will cost this much, it'll take this long. I'm going to say lazy like that. I love it when they say we'll do that because I'm like, fine, it's out. And I put it on a wall as out of scope. I'm not even going to.
But if it's something that you're dependent on.
They've taken the risk of building it and the responsibility of building it. If I have to build my thing, that thing comes along later, last to come along does the integration. And it's like building out scope, integrating out scope. And it's all right for me to say this because I wasn't in your situation. And I wasn't dealing with those stakeholders or those technical people. So I don't know how that conversation would have gone.
That was actually exactly what we did back in my previous previous clients. So we have a large dependency on the Hobart team. And then they were like, yeah, we'll do that. And then 2 weeks before release, we were like, so are you guys doing this? I'm like, no, you're doing that. We'll finish our development and this is the call. We're not changing it anymore. You guys take it, integrate it, whatever you're doing, make it work. Yeah, so that's what we're like.
But I guess I'm looking at this team and thinking you're far more caring professionals than I am. Because I'm like, no, you're dead to me now. That thing's dead to me. I'm going to do this thing.
Mm.
But I think you worry about the whole picture.
But it's good to have that early on while that's dead to me. Conversation, then later on, people thinking that it's actually your fault that it's not delivered.
For me, it's one of those moments where I can worry about it, but you had enough to worry about, or I can go, breathe and just, out of school.
Good. I know we're kind of running out of time, well, we already have. So, also another thing, too large to estimate, we'll get to that later. Doesn't seem too important, this piece. We had a couple of things like that hanging around. Deal with it early on, don't let it hang around. Technology constraints. Okay, I just listed a few smells. I'm sure the rest of the team, that's a topic on its own for probably a day. But a custom framework, if your client built a custom framework and you're going to deal with that, it's a bit of a smell. It's going to be hard to get read up anything about it. And you're probably going to be very reliant on their team members who probably are very busy as well. So just take that into consideration. Limited test environments and way too expensive to spin up more. That's definitely going to delay you. You're going to run into some time where some test environment is down or someone needs to do an upgrade and you won't be able to get your code on there. Customized external libraries. So, these guys use some open source libraries. Good. They customize them. Not so good. Because when you need to upgrade them, you'll probably not be able to. Tight coupling with backend. So whenever you see anything about your code, having to use IDEs of some like backend system and understand the backend system's internal mechanisms, big warning sign. And then backend team is Waterfall team. So they'll be ready for you in 2 months, 1 day, 6 hours, and 2 minutes. Don't worry about it. We'll have it ready for you. It's probably not going to be ready. Or if it's ready, it's not going to be what you expect it to be. Anything else you wanted to add?
I had a dime for every set. I heard people say, it's done.
But yeah.
When it wasn't done.
Yeah.
Different
yeah.
definitions of done across the
yeah.
organization.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah, make sure it's done is done, then assume it will work. Visualize your dependencies, big on the wall. Numbers talk, visualize how big the impact is, and this goes also for dependencies on like a platform where it's a slow build. Mm-hmm. If you can actually show, and this is something that Nick talked about as well, if you can show them how long you actually wait and how much time you've wasted because of a certain thing, then it can give them the perspective on how big of a problem it is.
I add on there the monetary value. So this much time, this many people, this is the monetary value. Or
that's probably what you can have in that side conversation. Like convert that into money.
Or the number of new features this cost.
Mm.
It's an amazingly effective way of mobilizing stakeholders. Here's the cost or the lost value.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Talking about the build time, like that wasn't really a super simple conversation because the reason why the tests were slow was because we couldn't figure out how to do unit tests in the framework that we're living. So that's actually a conversation about the framework. So it's not just the build's slow. It goes to a whole lot of other problems as well.
I think it's also a pain point for other developers as well, because we have the same problems there. And then our pipeline runs 3 hours. So each build runs 3 hours, pull test, not build. Just run test is 3 hours. So the other person and I were just pretty much sitting there not doing anything, because if I run test, she can't do anything because they'll conflict the cloud environment. So it's every time we run a test, it's two of us 6 hours, and any other client developers can't do anything either. So
yes.
It's like 12 hours a day, you're not doing anything. And it's a pain point for them as well, because they have this metrics to make, right? They have to write how many points, how many stories,
yes.
And then you have to ship your pain points to them so that they'll help you to fix the problem.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say is, just by starting, by highlighting the scale buys you invariably the right to investigate the cause.
Yeah.
And then you can start talking about the cause and what it takes to fix each piece of the cause.
Yeah.
So you almost want to do the same thing you do with projects,
yeah.
which is break them down.
But I think one of the problems with that was that we couldn't even agree on what the problem was. Because as far as they were concerned, the problem was that we were writing too many of the UI tests and too many tests in general. So it wasn't like their answer to that was, okay, we'll just don't write so many tests.
Did you guys, it's not forensic discussion, I know it's not. Did you guys have tiered build for your tests?
So what, running a certain subset of test first and then one place? Well, we couldn't do unit testing at all, so there was no fast feedback cycle. But we did make a significant amount of progress during the project, and we reduce the build time to so 40 minutes, so point by 80%, which across a 300-person program is real
it's
money.
Massive.
It's real money, and it's a lasting impact as well. So there are really statistically significant wins that we have made through innovation, but that's really hard to get recognised when
and
you're on the back foot.
It's a real shame that stuff gets lost because it's a fantastic value add that you guys were able to bring.
Yeah. This is my last slide, client politics. So Big Smell if you come to a business and it's business versus IT, and you work for one of them. So actually at the end of our inception, well, not even the end, but when we started realizing that this timeline is not gonna fit into mm-hmm. what they thought it would be, we actually tried to call in the program manager and then the head of product to discuss the issue. So at that point, we couldn't find the program manager, but because we already called in the head of product, you know, we just mentioned to her the reason why we called her. And it kind of felt the next day that we were called into a principal's office.
Yeah, why did you tell got,
this? Got like a big stick. You don't tell business this. You tell us, you work for us. We can look at alternatives and then go to the business. So it's, you can just already see the signs of messages being blocked. And so, yeah.
So all the things that we think are good culturally, like the way we operate as a company, like that doesn't exist. This is a very scary world, but like your paymasters are in the business of controlling information. You've got to make that look good.
That's yeah. Right. Also, being the vendor in an unsafe environment where employees have to cover their own, you will probably be blamed quite often. Just be aware of that. And then also, kind of, that's just my general observation, but too many project managers and middle managers, lots of filtering, lots of, I don't know, it makes the environment more susceptible for messages or the perception about your team to be altered to other people. So I think when you see that, just be even more vigilant to have more brown bags, more out there, so that people can see directly what impact you have to the organization. And that's it. And that's where we worked. That's our wall back there. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Seriously, thank you so much for sharing and for putting yourselves out there, because it is hindsight, and we're always culturally, we're a company full of people who give ourselves a hard time after the fact. But thanks for sharing. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Cool. Thanks, guys.